Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to have a visit today with a man I've come to admire greatly about a problem that I believe I speak for all of us is very concerning. And that is what has happened to Israel. I might even back the lens up to the beginning of the Biden administration, but for the present purpose, let's start with October 7th, the date on which a terrorist organization that has misruled the Gaza Strip for about two decades now attacked Israel, caught it by surprise, inflicted immense harm on its people, as well as precipitated now a war that is very, very intense in the Gaza Strip and in parts of Israel as well, and has the potential to move into other parts of the region as well. Our guest is Rabbi Pesach Walicki. He is a leading voice on Jewish-Christian relations. He has a podcast called Shoulder to Shoulder Podcast. He publishes his commentaries and analyses and articles at Israel 365 News. He's a friend, as I say, a man that I have developed a particular admiration for because of his clarity, both of thought and the way he articulates those thoughts for especially audiences like ours, foreign audiences that may not fully understand what's going on in his homeland of Israel and of the Jews, and what, frankly, is in store for us as well, depending on how this all plays out. Rabbi Walicki, it is such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for giving us a full hour of your time. We're deeply appreciative. This is an evolving story, of course. This program will air in a day or two from when we are first conversing about it, but I trust you'll be able to keep it evergreen as much as possible. You know the business. Thank you again for coming, and welcome.
Thank you, Frank. You know, unfortunately, it's pretty easy to keep this topic evergreen because the battle against those who want to destroy the Jewish people and prevent us from taking possession of the land of Israel has been going on since we left Egypt, you know, we have a line in the Passover Haggadah, which is the text that we read at the Passover Seder, the meal Passover night. In there, there's a line that says, "In every generation, there are those who rise up against us to destroy us," and the Holy One, blessed be He, in the end, bails us out. But that doesn't mean we don't have to do the work. So, yeah. There'll be no problem keeping this evergreen, Frank.
Good. Passage from the Bible, of course, reminds me of a kind of variation on the theme that my old boss, Ronald Reagan, famously said, that every generation faces an existential threat to freedom. And both are true. And both, I think, probably reinforce the main point that what we'll talk about today has long reaching implications for sure, as well as a lot of history behind it. So, Rabbi, just in case anybody on this program hasn't been tuning in recently, would you just sort of level set for us what happened on the 7th of October, as you understand it now, and what were the immediate repercussions of it?
Well, what happened on October 7th, and I'm going to sprinkle in, I guess, some of my own personal account, because everyone in Israel was celebrating the festival that day. It was the Sabbath. It was Shabbat, which was also, it turned out this year that the eighth day of Tabernacles, which in the Bible is simply called the eighth day feast, which is really it's the capstone of the whole festival season that begins with Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, goes through the Day of Atonement, and then the Feast of Tabernacles, which is, it's in our liturgy, it's referred to as the most joyous time of year. On that final day, which is a day of great celebration, it's like, the end of the festival season, they chose to attack us. And it wasn't a mistake that they chose to attack us, Frank. We have to understand this from a security perspective. In the Israeli army, soldiers always want to get out for 24-hour leave. You know, when someone in the U.S. Army is deployed in Afghanistan, 24-hour leave wouldn't do much for them. But Israel's a tiny country. And I speak as someone, I should add in, Frank, that I have currently, I have three children and a son-in-law. So really four children who are in combat units who are down there in the front line, at the front lines or beyond. So I speak as, you know, every family's a military family, but I have a lot of kids and we're a very military family. Let's say that.
And you've served yourself.
And I've served myself. Israel Defense Forces. Years ago. They aren't calling me anymore. But thank God I know what my role is. My role is to be here talking to you.
You are a warrior in the war of ideas.
I'm trying.
The information battle space for sure.
Right. So they, when they release soldiers always want to get out for, you know, for the Sabbath, you know, for Shabbat at the end of the week, or they want to get out for one of the festival days. And I know from my own kids serving in their units over the years, and I had another child who served 3 years in the Army. She hasn't been called in for reserve duty yet in this war. That there's a kind of, you know, this week these soldiers will go home, that week those soldiers will go home. And during the course of the festival season, where security is ramped up, soldiers are released less often because there's a lot of tourists around, so there's more security concerns. But when you get to the end of the festival and everything's been nice and quiet, that's when the commanders kind of, with a wink and a nudge, look at all the soldiers who didn't yet get a day off over the festival season. And it's like the last chance to go home for one of the festival days. So specifically on the last day of the festival season, there were probably more enlisted men at home with their families than usual.
Men and women.
Right. Yeah. It was more, when I say men, I mean, of you know, the personnel.
Soldiers.
More of the enlisted personnel would have been home.
Right.
So that was probably part of their calculation of our enemies, that our guard would be down.
There was also an anniversary about that time, was there not?
An anniversary for
Yom Kippur War.
The Yom Kippur War, right. The 50th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War on the secular calendar was right around the same date. On the Hebrew calendar, of course, it was a week and a half earlier. And that was very much on our minds. And I'm not, like, I assume that our enemies were cognizant of that and were trying to link them. But I'm saying from a tactical perspective, choosing the last day of the festival season was actually very smart.
Yeah. But I guess the point I was just making is that it's not uncommon.
Right. It's not
when these jihadis are operating that they try to call up, in some cases, actually defeats, but to revenge their losses or to, have, I guess, some kind of commemoration of them at least. Yeah. And the point here is that in the Yom Kippur War as well, there was a very significant failure of intelligence, and we'll talk a little bit about that. I know you probably want to reserve judgment on exactly what happened until these investigations are done.
It's not my area of expertise. I mean, I know more than what's in the media. I have people who are I'm one step removed from people who know, let's say that. And the people I've spoken to who've explained what took place there, look, Frank, I'll only say it's not my lane and it's not where I make my greatest contribution to your audience, but I'll say, what happened here in short is an age old problem. And here I'm parroting what I heard from, again, inside experts who I rely on and I trust. This isn't just my own layman's analysis. When a military force starts relying too much on advanced technology and lets their guard down at the level of human resources, their enemies will figure out a way around it. As one security expert said to me, he said, there is yet to be a technology invented that can stop a determined human being. And what happened here...
Countermeasures always abound.
Right. It's always...
The creative backfill. Human being gets that done. We have to take a short break, Rabbi Pesach. We'll be right back with more. Rabbi Pesach Walicki is our guest. We'll hear more about his personal insights into what happened and what came next right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On Wednesday, President Biden will dignify a serial strategic arsonist with a meeting in San Francisco. Worse yet, he's expected to reward Chinese dictator Xi Jinping, who apparently greenlighted invasions of Ukraine by Russia and Israel by Hamas, with promises of intensified engagement with America. Incredibly, yet another bailout of Xi's failing Chinese Communist Party comes as it prepares to ignite Tinder, the CCP's created here over decades of unrestricted warfare against us, notably by hollowing out our industrial base, attacking us with a biological weapon, dividing us with cultural Marxist initiatives like racist diversity, and capturing elites supposed to protect us against such assaults. Even now, Xi is weaponizing TikTok, literally to inflame support for Hamas and smuggling in military personnel to light his next fire across America on command. We should be prosecuting this arsonist, not further enabling him. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are having a conversation with a man who has an extraordinary ability to not only analyze events of importance to his nation of Israel and to, I think, Western civilization, but to articulate those thoughts. And his name is Rabbi Pesach Wailiki. He is a native of Israel, has served in the Israel Defense Forces. These days, he is the host of Shoulder to Shoulder podcast, and I commend it to you all. Rabbi, you were talking a little bit about the environment on the eve of this attack and the lowering of the reliance on human intelligence, which the Mossad is, you know, famous for in the Gaza Strip, is something that most people who have known of the prowess of Israeli intelligence in the past have found incredible.
Yeah,
but
listen,
what you said, I think, is telling here. You mentioned earlier that it was nice and quiet, and that seems to have been a profound influence on, among others, general officers who, even when confronted with some evidence that things were about to go bad, suggested that they weren't to be concerned about it.
Look, in that sense, it's really the same as the Yom Kippur War, where whenever you have a strong power that looks at their enemy and says they wouldn't dare, they're not going to try this. That's where you let your guard down. And specifically here, I'm sure your listeners are interested in some of the details. I'll just share a few of them. But again, it's not my expertise. But from what I've been told, what happened here was the fence along the Gaza border goes deep into the ground and has this whole elaborate sensor system. And the sensors pick up any movement at a certain distance, and they have a technology that is called in Hebrew ro'eh yoreh, which is a nice play on words. Ro'eh means see, and yoreh means fire. And it means it sees, it fires. And it's an automatic firing system that attacks anything that's in motion at a certain distance from the fence or making contact with the fence. And this system has worked great. It keeps people away from the fence. And the over-reliance on this system is what led directly to this attack. What our enemies did was so low tech. What they did was they purchased the kind of drones you could buy on Amazon or in Walmart, and they attached explosives that were then dropped on the sensors themselves. Now, why weren't these drones picked up? Not enough human bodies along the border. If they didn't have this system, they would have had human beings patrolling the border, right? But they dropped explosive devices on the sensors. That disabled the sensors, and then they simply drove bulldozers through the fence.
Yeah. So, Rabbi, we can go on and on about this. I think the important point is that Israel was surprised.
Right.
And what happened as a result of the surprise was not only surprising, but absolutely unspeakably awful. Can you give us just a quick appreciation of that?
Look, what should shock us is the scale of what they did. But we should not be shocked by what they did. What I mean by that is Hamas has been breaking into homes and slaughtering entire families, slaughtering children and the elderly for years and years. That's what they always do. But usually when they do it, it's very limited. There will be the occasional attack where it's one family, and those are terrible attacks. And in Israel, we remember them all. We remember their names. For example, there was the Fogel family a few years ago on a Shabbat, on a Friday night. Terrorists broke into their home, slaughtered the family. We've had slaughters of children, elderly. We've had this before. We've had hostages taken before. So we shouldn't look at Hamas and say, oh my gosh, they're capable of such evil. They've always wanted to do exactly this. Now, in the country that day, because it was a festival, because it was a Sabbath, a huge percentage of the country are observant Jews. We don't have our phones on. We're not watching media. So we didn't really know what was going on. We heard the air raid sirens. But then once it became clear what was happening, for the first time in my life, Frank, I drove my car on the Sabbath, because the Bible says not to light a fire on the Sabbath day, and that includes the combustion in the engine of a car. So we don't drive our cars on the Sabbath. First time in my life I did, because life and death situations override Sabbath law, and I had to take my son to where he was going to be picked up to go right into battle that day. And I haven't seen him since. The tone in the country changed that day. I've lived in Israel. I appreciate you said I'm a native of Israel. I'm not a native. I've lived there for 30 years, and I lived there some of my childhoods. If you add it all up, I'm close to being a native. My children are natives. But I've lived in Israel for 30 years, and I've never seen the country like this. Everyone's in a state of pain and mourning, but also there's a sense of resolve and focus and understanding of what we need to do. Because what happened there that day is we were told that the time is now. Since you mentioned in your intro that Hamas took over the Gaza Strip after Israel left the Gaza Strip, and everyone must know this, Israel forcibly evacuated over 8,000 Israelis, taking away their homes, their farms, their factories, who had lived there for decades. People picture settlements as little roof, you know, like a hilltop tents and corrugated, you know, metal huts. That's not what they are. You've been to these settlements before, Frank. You know, and there's shopping malls, there's homes that have been there for decades, schools, synagogues. Israel forcibly evacuated all the settlements in the Gaza Strip. They took out all the military presence from the Gaza Strip. They gave the keys to the Palestinian Arabs and said, here you go. Go ahead, self-rule. And what they did was they, in short, ended
an occupation of
exactly.
The Gaza Strip.
When people say that there's an occupation of the Gaza Strip, we can get into what that term means and why it's actually the wrong term. We could have that conversation. Frank, we could do hours and hours. But but exactly, whatever people call an occupation, Israel ended it. For the Gaza Strip, Israel left completely. But they left completely. They didn't just leave and lock the fence. They left and still allowed Gazans to come into work in Israel, still providing vital infrastructure needs like electricity and water.
They wanted, in short, peace.
Absolutely.
With the Palestinian community.
Absolutely.
In Gaza. And what, just briefly, because we got to get back to where we are at the moment. What was the upshot of... first, the political evolution of that area, and then the security evolution.
Well, what happened as a result of the Hamas takeover?
As a result of the Hamas election.
The Hamas election, right. Hamas was elected. So this is something everyone has to know this, and your listeners need to know the talking points. And a lot of people listening, you probably don't think of yourself as an influencer. You might say, oh, I'm not on social media so much. Everyone knows someone, you're standing around the water cooler at work, you have friends, you have family, you have to share this information. Because we're in an information war. And in the information war, everyone is a combatant. And the information war is not separate from the military war. The extent to which—
And even if you're not a combatant, Rabbi, I would just say you're a target.
Oh, absolutely.
You are being influenced if you are not influencing as well.
For
so
sure.
this is why we relish the chance to have a
for sure. So let's talk
them.
About
so
this Hamas
finish that
point.
Point.
This Hamas point is one that I want your listeners to really understand so that they can articulate it. We call Hamas a terrorist group because we don't want to give them the legitimacy to call them anything else. But let's understand that the phraseology of calling them a terrorist group conjures up in the minds of most people some like underground criminal organization that's hiding from the law, working in basements. That's not what they are. They are the duly democratically elected government of the Gaza Strip. In all polling, both Palestinian polling and Western pollsters who've gone in ever since then, they are popular. And they're popular not only in the Gaza Strip. And I'll explain why I'm making this point. I'll make this point and I'll explain why it's critical. This is a critical point. The numbers of Hamas's popularity, so as recently as July 2023, which is like 10 seconds ago, as recently as July 2023, the Washington Institute polling shows that close to 60% of Gazans, I think it's 57% of Gazans is the number, according to that poll, have a favorable view of Hamas. And the percentages in the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, and in East Jerusalem are similar. Now, why is that so important? Because some people might claim, well, you can't really poll the citizens of Gaza because they live under this terrible totalitarian
Rabbi,
rule.
I beg your pardon. I have to stop you. We've sure. gone over the time. We'll be okay. right back with more with Rabbi Pesach Welicki okay. right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I apologize for having to interrupt Rabbi Welicki, our guest, for this full hour. I find myself, as is often the case, Rabbi, getting completely caught up in the stories and insights of our guest, and sometimes I have to crash into a hard break. There we did.
Understood.
You were talking about why it is so important that the sentiments of those in the so-called Palestinian communities, not just in Gaza, but in the areas known historically as Judea and Samaria, popularly called these days the West Bank, reflect a similar support. And again, it's not just for the organization, it's for its mission.
For sure.
And before you get into the sentiment and all that, talk a little bit about what is the mission of Hamas that is so widely supported, apparently.
Thank you for framing it that way, Fran, because it's true. Before I get to why that data point I was sharing is so important, we have to understand what these people are supporting. Hamas is not a Palestinian independence organization. Hamas was founded by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, who had founded the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood in 1973. And then in the early 80s, he founded Hamas. And Hamas, what the acronym stands for, I don't speak Arabic, but it stands for it's the paramilitary wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, the armed military force of the Muslim Brotherhood.
So it's a different name, but it's still a franchise.
It's the Muslim Brotherhood, meaning the Muslim Brotherhood branch in Gaza then started a paramilitary wing, and they named that Hamas. Okay. Now, the person who mentored and aided Sheikh Ahmed Yassin in the founding of the Muslim Brotherhood branch in Gaza and in founding Hamas, meaning his mentor, his teacher, was Abdallah Azzam. And all your listeners should be familiar with who he is. Abdallah Azzam was this thinker and leader in the Muslim Brotherhood. He was mostly stationed in Afghanistan, but he was a global leader. His nickname is the father of global jihad. And he was also the mentor of Osama bin Laden and helped him found Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, of course, spawned ISIS. The military academy, just to drive this point home, the military academy in Gaza, Hamas's military academy, the sign over the door refers to it as the Dr. Abdallah Azzam Academy. Okay, so this is who Hamas is. Their goals are the same as ISIS, as the same as Al-Qaeda. There's nothing to do with political independence in the Gaza Strip or the West Bank or anything like that.
Not living side by side in peace with Israel, for
right.
example.
The charter of Hamas, their founding document to this day, does not call for Palestinian independence or an end to occupation or whatever other of that terminology. It calls for the death of all Jews in the world. Literally, it calls for the genocide of the Jewish people, not the Israeli people, the Jewish people, and calls for the complete destruction of the state of Israel. So that is what Hamas stands for. That's what they say they stand for. And they've never backed away from that stance. That's who they are. So now when we talk about the fact that the overwhelming majority of the Gazan population and the West Bank Arabs and East Jerusalem Arabs, who are also very important in this data point, all share a similar admiration for Hamas and support its aims. In fact, polling from 2021 shows that when asked if they'd prefer the leadership of the Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas or Hamas, in all of those territories, the preference is for Hamas, which is why the Palestinian Authority hasn't had an election in a long time, even though they're supposed to have one every 4 years, because everyone knows that if there's an election in the West Bank, in Ramallah and in Jenin and in all these places, if there's an election, Hamas is going to win there too. So what's so important about this polling that shows the support for Hamas in these other places is that it gives lie to the claim that many would like to make that Hamas is oppressing the people of Gaza. Really, they want to be free of Hamas as well. And the only reason they might answer pro-Hamas talking points on a poll is that they're afraid to tell the truth the same way people living in Soviet Russia would be afraid to answer a poll. But the Arabs who live in the West Bank don't live under Hamas. There'd be no reason at all for them to choose Hamas over the PA, who rules them, in a poll. In fact, if by that same logic, they should be saying that they don't support Hamas. They're actually saying they support him. And this is doubly true for the Palestinians who live, the Arabs who live in East Jerusalem. The Arabs who live in East Jerusalem don't even live under the Palestinian Authority. They live fully under Israel's control because East Jerusalem is a fully annexed part of the state of Israel. So they live in a free Western society. They can walk down the same streets in the same shopping malls that I do in Jerusalem. And their polling there also shows overwhelming support for Hamas, which means that unless we embrace some absurdity that would say that the people in Gaza are opposed to Hamas, those who've been, who 20 years worth of education in a Hamas education system with Hamas media, Hamas TV stations, Hamas radio stations.
And the help of the UN, by the way.
Yeah. And yeah. Listen, when the hostages were dragged back and the corpses were dragged back into Gaza City, when these savages went back into Gaza City on October 7th, they were greeted by cheering crowds.
So, Rabbi, let me ask you this. And there's so many different pieces to this that we can't do justice to it even in a full hour. But the bottom line is that, obviously, if the sentiments of the population of Gaza are as you've described them, to say nothing of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, the idea that there will be a solution to this problem brought about by the Palestinian Authority taking charge in the Gaza Strip, or for that matter, that a separate Palestinian state on the West Bank will be anything other than a Hamas stan in due course, if not right out of the gate. This really gives lie to the argument that what we need now, I'm getting ahead of the story because I want to talk a bit about what Israel is doing, but we need a ceasefire. We need to get back to the negotiating table to trade land for peace and two-state solution.
Right.
So before we come back to that, and we will, just catch us up. After the horrors of October 7th, the surprise, the back foot that Israel found itself on, the loss of life, the horrible mistreatment of so many, and the capture, taking hostage of some. What has the Israeli response been to date, aside from what you described in terms of unity among the population? Militarily, I'm talking about, what has been done so far?
Well, the Israeli response started out with a few weeks of air attacks. And many people, including myself, many people in Israel were like, okay, where's the ground invasion? Now, usually in Israel, over the last 20 years, there's been, those who've been watching the Middle East know this, but for those who might not be as informed, there's been this kind of drumbeat of occasional flare-ups. Every couple of years, Hamas's rocket fire gets a little too intense, and the Israelis go in and we smack them down and bomb a few strategic targets, and that keeps them quiet. And then they rebuild, and they rebuild stronger.
Mow the lawn is the expression.
Right, we mow the lawn, exactly. Right. But everyone in Israel has always known that at some point down the road, we're going to have to clean up this mess. Okay, and that's really where we were brought to. So because of that, whereas in past conflicts, whether or not there'd be a ground incursion in one of these, like in 2014 was the last ground incursion, whether or not there's going to be a ground incursion would always be a hot issue of debate. And I would say that the majority would often be against it because it means a lot of loss of life of soldiers. And can we tamp down the problem without losing soldiers on the ground? This time, there's no such talk. On the contrary, unanimity across the board, pretty much, the extremists on the left end, notwithstanding, but they're always going to be there. But practically unanimity in the media. There's no more left and right in the media. Unanimity that we have to go in on the ground, even though everyone knows the costs will be high. We have to go in the ground and we have to defeat Hamas. And let me explain why, in light of what you just said before about the prospects for the future in this population. I've been asked in a number of interviews in the last few weeks, what about the day after? Let's say you're victorious, you get rid of Hamas. Now you have this population that hates your guts. They've been raised as jihadis. You've destroyed Hamas. What next? It's a good question. And it is perilous because who knows what the West is going to step in with, the Biden administration is going to step in with and try to impose upon Israel. But as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can see, when you look at history, let's ask the question about Imperial Japan. Let's ask the question about Nazi Germany. These were regimes whose population supported them. Imperial Japan, you know, those, you know, especially as a Jew, but generally as Westerners, a lot of us tend to look at World War II and we look more to Europe as the main stage. But anyone who studies the Pacific theater knows that the scale and the level of atrocities that the Imperial Japan was involved in was really on par with the Nazis. And I say that as a Jew who lost lots of family in the Holocaust, but the Imperial Japan was an evil empire. We know that. And we know the way they fought like jihadis. And if you asked yourself at the time, what's going to happen? What's going to be the day after? And the answer is, with evil regimes, you have to bring them to their knees. And you have to bring them to their knees, not because it's a matter of revenge or even a matter of justice, but because the only way to get them to really change and really wake up out of their stupor is to defeat them. Nazi Germany, Germany today, the German population today, by and large, is a moderate, peaceful population. Same is true in Japan, because they were brought to their knees. And there's no way we're going to change the Arab world unless they really taste defeat.
Yes. And arguably, this has been a problem for quite some time, where they've been encouraged to believe they weren't defeated previously by Israel, even though, obviously, in a number of instances, they decisively were. Rabbi, we're going to take another short break. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On Wednesday, President Biden will dignify a serial strategic arsonist with a meeting in San Francisco. Worse yet, he's expected to reward Chinese dictator Xi Jinping, who apparently greenlighted invasions of Ukraine by Russia and Israel by Hamas, with promises of intensified engagement with America. Incredibly, yet another bailout of Xi's failing Chinese Communist Party comes as it prepares to ignite Tinder, the CCP's created here over decades of unrestricted warfare against us, notably by hollowing out our industrial base, attacking us with a biological weapon, dividing us with cultural Marxist initiatives like racist diversity, and capturing elites supposed to protect us against such assaults. Even now, Xi is weaponizing TikTok, literally to inflame support for Hamas and smuggling in military personnel to light his next fire across America on command. We should be prosecuting this arsonist, not further enabling him. This is Frank Affney. We're back with Rabbi Pesach Walicki. He is the host of a terrific podcast program, Shoulder to Shoulder. You can also follow his writings at Israel 365 News. Rabbi, so much to talk about, but very quickly, I did want to ask you, Israel has now gone in on the ground. It has made great strides in, it seems, essentially sealing off the northern part of the Gaza Strip from the southern part surrounding the city of Gaza City, that's called. How's it going? Has the loss of life on the Israeli side been as bad as you thought it was? And how would you respond to the criticism that what Israel is doing is indiscriminate and disproportionate?
Thank you for asking. In terms of how well it's going, I'm gonna be very upfront with you, Frank. Anyone who says they know who isn't in the Situation Room doesn't know what they're talking about. We don't know how well it's going. Israel is very careful about what it releases to the media during a war, and I'm not going to pretend to know. In terms of the loss of life, that we do know. We know when families get told of their children being lost. And before I came to the States on this trip to speak about the war everywhere, before I left a couple weeks ago, I already attended funerals of children of friends of mine who had fallen on the battlefield. And so whether or not the loss of life is worse than expected is hard to say, because everyone in Israel knows that it's going to be bad. I mean, this is something very important people to understand about the mindset of the Israeli people right now. We know that we will be sacrificing our children. We know that. We know that they're going into battle, and we know that they're laying down our lives, but there's a sense of resolve and determination and understanding that we have to do this for our survival. Now, in terms of what you said about proportionality, this is so critical for people to understand, because this canard that Israel's being disproportionate is based on really a childish understanding. I have no better word for it, a childish understanding of the term disproportionate. Dennis Francis at the UN, at the General Assembly, said it. And on the media, they say it all the time. I was sitting in a hotel room in Canada last week, and I turned on the news, and they showed the number of casualties in Israel on October 7th and the number of alleged casualties in the Gaza Strip, a number they probably got from the reliable Hamas health services or something. But regardless of the reliability of the number—
You say that facetiously, of course.
Facetiously, but even if it's true, the idea that proportionality is a bean counting game about how many people were killed on each side is absurd. And as soon as people hear the correct definition of proportionality in warfare, they realize how absurd that earlier understanding is. According to the Geneva Convention, proportionality—
On the laws of war.
In the laws of war. Meaning, according to the international laws of war, basically, there's a rule of proportionality. What is considered proportional response, or what is considered proportional activity militarily? And here's what it says. The principle of proportionality forbids causing harm to civilians or civilian property that would be, and here's the quote, excessive in relation to the concrete and direct military advantage which is anticipated by the military action. Let me put that into simpler terms, okay? When you say something's proportional, you mean in relation to something else. That's what proportionality means. So when people say this is disproportionate, they look at what Hamas did and they say, wow, what Israel's doing is so much more, that's disproportionate. But that's not the proper measure of proportionality. If someone is, imagine, Frank, that someone was attacking you and trying to kill you. And I jumped in and subdued the attacker and I was sitting on them on the ground. I had them completely subdued and they're not going to kill you anymore. And then I pull out my gun and I shoot them in the head while I'm sitting on top of them. I didn't have to shoot them to stop them from killing you. That shot to the head is disproportionate. Why? Because the objective of my action, taking and ending the threat to you, in that particular situation, proportionality meant that the action I took, the second action I took was disproportionate, and I shouldn't have done that. Because the proportionality is not measured by the fact that he wanted to kill you, so I'm killing him. Proportionality is measured by the objective of the military action. So here in Israel.
But on the other hand, if just to stay with your analogy for one more second, if he had to be shot to keep him from killing you, that would be
then it's proportional. Right. Proportionality is measured against the military objective. So, for example, if there's a building in the Gaza Strip that is being used as a launching pad for missiles, and it happens to be a school or it happens to be a hospital, but it has to be taken out because it's a military target, and Israel has set up a safe zone where civilians could go, and Israel has dropped leaflets and said that everyone should get out of this place, and then Israel strikes the target, and however many civilians die, that is a tragedy that Hamas is responsible for, because they are preventing people from leaving. They're preventing the civilians of Gaza from going to the safe zones. They want them dead. Their main operation center is in a tunnel directly underneath the largest hospital in Gaza City. They do that deliberately to make it difficult for Israel so that Israel gets demonized. But let's talk about, again, this argument of proportionality. It's so easy to fall into this because the word sounds like equity, right? Like equal. But that's not what it means. Are you doing what you need to do militarily and nothing more? So if I bomb the building with the rocket launchers on it, that is proportional. If I bomb the other buildings around it just to send a message, that could be deemed disproportionate. That's a discussion. So proportionality is measured against the military objective. It's not measured against what the other side did. That's the key point about proportionality, which leads into all this stuff about humanitarian aid. And we have to talk about this, Frank, because it really relates to how the Biden administration is behaving. It was widely reported right after Biden's visit and Blinken's visit that the U.S. was pressuring Israel to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza. And also there was a lot of hay made. And unfortunately, Frank, it wasn't only coming from the left. There are a lot of voices, unfortunately, on the right who have bought into this stuff. How could Israel cut off the water and electricity to Gaza? So let's talk about these humanitarian issues. So again,
we have to ask you to pause just a second, Rabbi. Sure. We've got one more break. I want to make sure we don't interrupt you in this. Yeah. Let me just say,
this is a big point. This is a big
an excellent video by Rabbi Wilicki at Israel 365 Action on that whole issue of discriminateness and proportionality, and it's very worthwhile viewing because you gave us a flavor of it, but you. I think expanded on it very nicely there. We'll talk about the next issue, the Biden administration's pressure for a humanitarian assistance to flow and perhaps a ceasefire as well. Be right back. Welcome back. We're visiting for one last segment with Rabbi Pesach Wilicki. We've been talking about so much related to the very difficult circumstances in which Israel finds itself, and the impact, of course, on the Palestinians and the wider region as well. And Rabbi, in the course of this, you were just describing how the Biden administration has been increasingly trying to ratchet up the pressure on Israel to allow so-called humanitarian assistance to reach the folks in Gaza to turn the water back on, to turn the telecommunications and other internet services and so on, electricity. And it seems to me it misses almost completely what is really going on here. And I'd just like you to talk a little bit about it as well as respond to this pressure. As it happens, a colleague of ours, Raymond Ibrahim, a remarkable journalist as well as historian, has reported that the so-called Muslim Vatican at Al-Azhar University, it's not exactly a Vatican, but it's a source of definitive religious guidance, it has issued a fatwa from its fatwa department, a fatwa being a religious edict, an order effectively, saying all Israeli lives are fair game. And that flows, according to this fatwa department, from, you know, Quranic teachings, from Sharia. So if that's that sort of spiritual dimension of this war is operating, then the humanitarian assistance, the ceasefires and so on are not likely to end well, do you think?
You could put that together, Frank, with the fact that the United States is bringing the Qataris in as a kind of honest broker. The Qataris are an Islamic regime that funds terrorism in the Gaza Strip. They're one of the funders of Hamas and one of the funders of Islamic Jihad.
So, and the Muslim Brotherhood more generally, by the
right,
way.
So I think at this point we have to say that it's not that the Biden administration isn't aware of the fatwa or isn't aware of the ideological underpinnings of what's going on. They have been doing everything in their power since taking office to improve their relations with Qatar and Iran at the expense of their relationships with the true moderates in the Arab world. And there are true moderates. The way the Saudi regime has been going, the way the Emirates have been going, those who signed the Abraham Accords really are looking ahead at some kind of new arrangement in the Middle East that's actually peaceful and prosperous for everyone. And the Biden administration has been undermining those relationships in favor of Islamic fundamentalists, basically, essentially the Muslim
Sharia
Brotherhood.
Sharia supremacists, I call them.
Yeah.
But, you know, and in so doing has emboldened them, I believe, to not only act as they have, but also to do so in a way that would directly impair and perhaps imperil those Abraham Accords. No?
Right. And Israel in general. I mean, they've hurt our security. Before I get to that, though, let's talk about this humanitarian stuff, because there's another talking point that all of your viewers and listeners need to understand in this information war so that they can share with others and also insulate themselves from this propaganda, really, which is, let's remind ourselves what I said earlier. Hamas is not a rogue organization. They're not a criminal organization in Gaza. They are the government, which means, let's play this out. The U.S. wants to send in humanitarian aid. Israel is refusing. Oh, they sound so cruel. Let's play it out. Trucks come in with humanitarian aid. They come to the gates of Gaza. Who receives them? Well, they're received by Hamas because that's the only leadership. And that means that the first supplies go down into the tunnels. What do I mean by the tunnels? Now, I've introduced the tunnels. Some of you who watch this closely are aware of the tunnels. Underneath the 24-mile Gaza Strip is a spider web network of 300 miles of tunnels. Now, these aren't little tunnels like a rabbit digs in the backyard. These are hundreds of feet underground, so far underground that bunker-busting bombs can't touch them. They have air conditioning. They have internet. They have electricity. They have running water. They are command centers, and they are munitions storehouses. There are currently an estimated 40,000 Hamas fighters living in those tunnels, hiding out there, waiting for the air barrage to finish. And that's the army that's waiting for the Israeli soldiers. Okay? Now remember, humanitarian aid enters Gaza. The civilians who are at risk and who are dying in bombings because the Hamas is not allowing them into the safe zone, those civilians aren't getting the humanitarian aid, and they're not getting the cover of the tunnels. They're not allowed in the tunnels. The tunnels are for the Hamas guys. And that's where all the food is going, and that's where all the water is going, and that's where all the fuel is going. Maybe they'll throw a few crumbs to everyone else for optics. But humanitarian aid in this particular war equals resupplying Hamas. And that's why Israel's been opposed. Israel wants to save more lives in the long run and get this done quickly. The longer Hamas can hold out in those tunnels underground, and the more ability they have to fight the Israelis, and the more civilian casualties mount, the harder it will be for Israel to end this quickly, thus saving more lives on both sides.
Yeah, so, quickly and decisively.
Yes. So when Israel speaks about cutting off water and electricity, this is a big one. You see it on Twitter. Oh, they're cutting off the water and electricity. Okay. The only way to get the Hamas underground 40,000 who are in the tunnels, the only way to smoke them out and get them to come up for air is by cutting off water and electricity to Gaza. Because there's only so long they can stay down in the tunnels without water and electricity. If Israel does not cut off the water and electricity to Gaza, we cannot fight them by going into the tunnels. The tactical disadvantage and the bloodshed of our soldiers will be so severe if we descend into the tunnels to fight them in the tunnels. So what we need to do is get them to come above ground. So next time you see a news story about humanitarian aid and about the tunnel and about cutting off water and electricity, understand that if we were allowed by the Americans who are twisting Israel's arms, if we were allowed to do what we need to do, this could end a lot more quickly with a lot less bloodshed.
Yeah. Rabbi, we are out of time. There's so much more to talk with you about.
Not to do it again, Frank.
Hope we will get you back very soon for an update. But let me just say, you have helped clarify so many aspects of this conflict and done so in a way that I think is not only very accessible to lay Americans, but also vitally needed, as you say, in this information warfare that is central to the fight Israel is in now, a fight that they are waging, I believe, very strongly on our behalf, as well as your own. God bless you, my friend.
Frank, if I could just have one sentence. Let's remember, our enemies, all these suicide bombing over the years, is our enemies are willing to die so that we will die. Amen. And we have to have we have to be dedicated to beat them.
We are hard out of time. God bless you. I hope the rest of you will join us next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.